Hey, it's Bobby Manning. Been a few weeks. Thank you for tuning in to Dome Theory Podcast. We have a packed show tonight. I thought we were just going to be talking Celtics NBA, and then I saw what happened in that debate tonight, and I was like, Jesus. All right, we have to say something about this. So second half, had my friend Rocco, had my friend Lindo Zay, who I usually talk politics on here when necessary. They're on the back end of the show, about 50 minutes in. First, we talk Celtics with Justin Poulin. They're eliminated at the hands of the Heat. I didn't feel as bummed as usual, probably because of the 3-1 deficit, probably because of all our frustrations getting out of the way after game 1 and 2 and those massive blown leads. Still, though, ton of second guesses, adjustments that need to be made going forward, possibly moves. Overall, though, I don't think they need to change a ton. We'll get into that with Justin here, though. I do a quick NBA Finals preview with Game 1 tonight. Get that out of the way. I do think the Heat have a chance here. Justin didn't think so as much, but it was a thrill to talk to Justin Poulin, host of Celtic Stuff Live here. He was one of my first guests on the show back when it was a Bobcast, and we had a great wide-ranging discussion with the Celtics here. Make sure you subscribe, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher. All those links are up at realbobmanning.com, as well as CLNS Media. And check out some of our postseason coverage we're doing over at CLNS Media. A few Garn reports going up tonight about the end of the season. Danny Ainge, Brad Stevens, all those different kind of things. Thanks for holding out the last couple of weeks. Playoffs are over. We'll have a lot more of these interviews coming up. And once every week. And here's Justin Poulin.
Dude, wow. I love it. You're like,
it is a thrill to do this. Justin Poulin is with us here today. This guy was one of my first guests when we got the Bobcast going 4 years ago. I remember him having me on Celtic Stuff Live when I was a freshman at college. And here we are 4 years later. The world's falling apart.
It's coming apart at the seams.
Yeah.
There's no doubt.
Think of all the hope. Think of all the hope and aspirations in 2016 that I had before that November. And now we're all at home. I can't complain too much. Yeah. Things have gone pretty well for me over the last couple of months. I've been able to work at CLNS Media, cover the Celtics run, and, you know, spend more time with the family. So You try to take the good with the bad. Justin Poulin, he hosts the Celtic Stuff Live podcast, one of the longest-running Celtics podcasters, a mentor to me, a friend to me. It's a blast to have you back on, man.
Yeah, man, it's good to be here. And, you know, the fact that you would even consider me a mentor is pretty flattering. I mean, I do remember that time we recorded. I actually remember exactly where I was sitting in my house, if you can believe it. It was a good conversation, and I think you were like, hey, what can I do? What can I do? And that's the thing about you, Bobby. You're a learner. You know, you're an adapter. You're a worker. And that's how you get things in life. You know, that's how you make best of bad situations. That's how you survive. So good for you.
It's so fitting now, too, because I remember one of the things I told you back then was I wanted to learn more than just sports broadcasting and sports journalism and all that different stuff. And the way the industry's gone, you do have to have more at your disposal. You have to know history. You have to know politics, right? Like, all this different stuff has converged on sports media, especially with what we've seen in the bubble. So, you know, I got to study a little bit of African-American history in college and, you know, get to know people from that background and talk about the issues and different stuff like that. And I don't consider myself an expert by any means, but to have the bubble be so oriented on those issues, I felt a little more prepared than I think some people who came into the industry in decades past to talk about those things.
Well, yeah. And I feel like the bubble definitely brought out, it brought out topics of conversation that were happening along the side. Like, if you want to talk about somebody who, you know, now writes for the Undefeated, but even when I covered the team when they won in 2008, you know, Mark Spears was a man that was highlighting a lot of these conversations. But, you know, he wrote for the Boston Globe, and I don't think that intersection, you know, as you're describing it, is of politics and culture and, you know, maybe a little bit. I'd say Black culture was definitely strongly influencing. You had a strong influence in the NBA, you know, just from music and from clothing and, you know, artistic influence of all kinds, I think had got, but politics, no.
Yeah,
not at all. And I felt like I had a lot of conversations with especially Mark Spears during that time where he had been talking about these things, if not in his writing, definitely with the people who were around him. And I feel like, you know, that was I think it was always been there. It just didn't come to the forefront. And definitely didn't ever heard anybody on national media, you know, having those kinds of conversations as part of the broadcast.
I mean, it was disqualifying for Colin Kaepernick to do that 4 years ago, and now it's the norm. You know, everybody has to do it to some degree, has to address it if they're, you know, part of the environment out there, which I think is admirable because it's hard to separate what's going on out in the world right now from, you know, what's happening on the court because these are predominantly Black people in this league who have felt in some cases themselves the Sterling Browns of the world. You know, Jimmy Butler talked about it too after the series. He wanted to have no name on his jersey because if he wasn't wearing the jersey, it could happen to him as well. So that's something since we last talked that's resonated most with me is that shift in the sports media landscape as well. And I think it was interesting to see reporters adjust to that too, because in certain press conferences, the players just wanted to talk about the issues of the world. They didn't want to talk about basketball, especially in the aftermath of the George Floyd situation and the protests that we saw, the strikes that we saw in the middle of the NBA bubble there. It was powerful stuff. It really was.
You know, but the thing is too, Bobby, is like even within the bubble, I don't think everybody all agreed.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's like one of the things here is like, you know, there are some people that will speak their mind on these issues, but they'll speak, you know, not from a place of experience, you know. And so in some cases, you know, it's just about, you don't have to have something to say about it is my point.
Yeah.
As much as you kind of just have to be able to see what's going on in the world and just take it for what people have to say, even if they're not experienced to talk about it, they're being influenced by it. You know, you look at like kind of the way that Jaylen Brown looked at the situation versus the way that LeBron James looked at the situation. Even within the bubble, there was not a, I don't want to say not a solidarity, but you see the same variation of opinions and attitudes, even in a very unified effort towards awareness.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, one of the things that's really important about that is recognizing everybody's humanity for what it is. Right. And some people live this every single day. Some people don't have any idea. You know, some people grew up with it, but then found themselves having a fortunate enough of a life that they don't have to face it every single day, but they remember what it was like when they grew up. Like, we're just a mishmash of all kinds of people with all kinds of different backgrounds. I think the thing that I respected about Jaylen and the bubble on this, and it's really the probably the most poignant thing that I read, honestly, like straight up, and I'm not trying to be a homer because I'm the one who cheered Jaylen Brown's selection. And, you know, I just want to get on the Jaylen Brown train. That's literally not it. It's very specifically where he said, look, if you want to cancel the season and go home, I'm cool with that.
What are you going to do?
But what are you going to do if you're saying that the reason you're going home is because, you know, this is troubling, and then the way that our world is troubling and you want to influence change, then you better damn go home and get involved. Cause otherwise we might as well play some basketball. Mm-hmm. Right. And I definitely, and I think Jaylen's probably preference would have been to cancel the season and go home and do those things. But I think he also knew that you weren't necessarily going to get that level of commitment from everybody who was in the bubble, you know, that they were going to go home and do those things. And, you know, I don't want to speak for Jaylen. You know, there's probably multiple layers to why he said that and what he meant by it and what he was willing to do himself. But we know he drove from Boston down to Atlanta. So we know what he was willing to do in terms of activism. And I'm not sure that everybody would want to do that level of activism. Mm-hmm. And for a variety of reasons. One thing that I think made it probably harder for anybody, and I can totally understand why you would want to go home, even if you didn't plan on being politically active, you know, and say, I'm going home because of this. One thing that I think, you know, I could understand completely is the separation from family.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, at a time when no matter what side you stand on with this, we could not feel more divided as a country, you know, feeling separated from your culture, your community, you know, and feeling uneasy, then being separated from your family. I mean, that's something that you really have to, you have to respect and understand that sacrifice regardless of who went to the bubble and who didn't.
Yeah. And it was spoke so casually throughout, like, oh, they're at Disney, you know, they got their catered food, they got their millions
of
dollars.
There's only
like
a few people that go to Disney without their families. So,
yeah,
you know, the fact that they were throwing Disney on it, like, well, Disney without your family is the most depressing thing I can think of, because I don't even really want to go to Disney, Bobby. I'm definitely not going without my family.
Yeah. Justin on the teacups by himself spinning around. They couldn't even go. They couldn't even go to the park. I mean, no. All they could do was swim in the pool and get their tan, like Ennis Cantor.
Brutal. I loved all the little poolside fights, though. That was fun.
Yeah. The day after the locker room debacle.
Right. No,
it was a make good. It was a make good. Yeah. We're all friends still. Everything we said all year was true. I want to stick on the bubble for one more second before we get to the Celtics, because that's what you mentioned is why the Doc Rivers firing rubbed me the wrong way a little bit yesterday, because the Clippers, absolutely massive disappointment. I picked them to win the NBA Finals coming into this year. I thought they were going to storm through the league. And you saw the reverberations of a team that acted like they were champions already by default through Kawhi, rested throughout much of the year, wasn't healthy, didn't set their rotations. There was just a casualness to that team rather than an urgency that you would expect from a team that was going to be a champion. I mean, that's how you blow a 3-1 lead. But we also see underlying things there. Paul George's mental health, his physical health clearly throughout the year was not very strong. You know, Montrezl Harrell being out a month with his mother's death. You know, the Lou Williams situation was its whole other thing. But a lot of stress factors, you know, pulling at this team. And of course, you expect the coach to be able to hold things together a little bit at that time. But I don't think anyone would question Doc Rivers' inspirational leadership in those moments and ability to bring people together. So sure, he didn't meet the basketball expectations of that moment. But I think in this situation specifically, the casualness with which franchises just let their guys go, whether it was Nate McMillan, Brett Brown, other things at work there, but so many coaches were fired out of this situation that I think was so abnormal. Like, you know, the Miami Heat are about to get all the praise in the world for their run, but do they do this in an environment where there's no home court? I think it's tough to imagine them doing it.
Yeah, it's tough to say. It's odd times, so you would expect odd behavior. And what you're actually saying is, it's odd times, so why are we getting normal behavior?
Yeah.
If you really think, if you really take what you said. Now, the Doc Rivers one, I don't know that I find as curious, and here's why. You know, he's been there a while.
Mm-hmm.
They've had criticism levied at him for not maximizing, like, we got you the players. Right. We traded away the draft picks. We spent the money. And I don't mean this go around. I mean previous iterations of the Clippers teams, you know, you didn't do it. And he was in tight and they'd blow it up and start over. And they were building towards this. And they won the gigantic lottery last year by getting Kawhi to come to LA. And they, you know, they built this team. They blew a 3-1 lead. I think if they blew a 3-1 lead against the Lakers, he's still the coach. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, it's the situation. And if we did take this out of the bubble, Doc Rivers gets fired.
Yeah.
I mean, straight up, he gets, you know, and maybe the Clippers don't lose is what you're saying, right? Maybe with not being in the bubble, maybe the Clippers, you know, meet those expectations.
I also think maybe you get something different from Paul George. Paul George's struggles were baffling. He looked like a bad player throughout much of the playoffs. And I know his shoulder's been screwed up all year, and that's another question for them going forward is his health and his viability as a star. But he said it himself. Mentally, he was checked out. There were other players in this bubble who just didn't want to be a part of it. Avery Bradley, Wilson Chan, the others who knew going in that this wasn't going to be an environment that they were going to thrive in. Others like George went, gave it a shot, and clearly just weren't able to make it happen. And I know people are going to kill them for that. Like, it seems like the easiest thing in the world to be able to go in there, even with everything happening in the world, and thrive on the court. Plenty of other players are doing it, but that doesn't mean specifically everyone's going to do it. And to hold Doc accountable for that, I think, is a little tricky. We'll see who they get. The replacement's going to be the big question. If they get
not a lot of great coaches.
Yeah.
Not a lot of great coaches. I mean, Doc's never wanted to be part of a rebuilding. You know, we used to always say, why won't you play the young guys? Why won't you play the young guys? Although I've heard a lot of people say that about Brad, and I don't know how they can say that about Brad. It's like all he's got is
Do you think Doc's a good coach?
I think Doc is a good people manager, and I think that he knows the game, but I think his influence is more holding a locker room together than it is like being like this outstanding strategic coach. Mm-hmm. You know, I think he gets a little rigid sometimes. I think his coaching style can be inflexible. And I think sometimes the criticism for him is warranted around not making adjustments. But some of that is what makes him so great in dealing with stars, because he's saying to the stars, and he was, you know, an amazing player himself. He's saying to those guys, we've got a game plan. The game plan's not hard. The game plan should work. If you do what you guys are capable of doing, we'll win these games. And he knows that he has to give them the confidence to go out and play their game, and that he has confidence in them. He's very good at not being divisive with those players, and there's nothing worse than losing an established star veteran, and it happens very easily. And when it happens, you know, how many coaches are casualties of that? Didn't work out. Couldn't get along with Kyrie, dude. Like, if Kyrie only signed 1 year deals, his coaches would sign 1 year deals.
Yeah.
You know, just and bang, that's bang, 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 bang.
So to some degree, Doc's the consequence of that Kawhi George 2 year deal, the whole situation they set up there.
100%.
And, you know,
expectations are now. They didn't meet the expectations. They came up way short. And and this is the other thing, right? This is a difficult time, okay? And there's lots of considerations and explanations, but there's never going to be a good excuse, especially when you think about the owner shelling out as much money as they are, right? And the revenue stream is whack. I mean, I don't know how they know what's going to all come of this, right?
That's what makes the coaching fight. They're going to pay Doc through 2022 to not coach.
Yeah.
Yes. That's what makes some of these coaching decisions puzzling.
But if they send a message to the players, right, and they have these contracts, it's kind of like one of those all or nothing on the table gambles, right? Like, hey, you guys want us to like accept the fact that you want to be in the bubble, but there's no excuses. We played basketball. You got paid a check, and it doesn't matter. I don't care who you are. You know what I mean? I mean, regardless of the social justice, you know, aspects of everything in the bubble, you know, I didn't get to not work my job during COVID. Do you know what I mean? I've been busting a hump every single day. I've been stuck in this 10 by 10 home office, you know, cranking out on my computer, and I got three jobs I do, you know, and we definitely had to lay people off, you know, at one of the companies. Like, we've all had to, you know, we brought a lot of them back, but, you know, everybody's had to make adjustments and deal with that. So my thing is, the expectations are the expectations, you know, and if you don't meet the expectations, somebody has to be accountable for that. And to your point, the players are never going to be accountable for it because their contract, nobody's going to, you don't just get rid of somebody, right? So if you think about the way the NBA is structured, if somebody has to be accountable to send a message, there's only one guy. Everybody else, I mean, what are you going to do, fire the trainer? And somebody's going to be like, ah, man, we're going to try harder next year.
The Celtics did that.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, they did. But I don't think it sent a message.
Hasn't worked. What are we, yeah. So I was counted out again today. 09, 10, 11, 12, 13, 16, 17, 18, and now 20. That's like 9 years that the Celtics have lost a key rotation player in the playoffs. It's unfathomable. Now, I gotta look at other situations because I'm sure it happens to a lot of teams. But what happened? Game one of the playoffs, they're rolling along. They're smoking the 76ers. And then you just see Hayward hobbling and you go, oh, no.
Well, the first thought was, is it the same ankle? Because he's gone.
Yeah. And he was gone anyway. Yeah. Oh, man. So, yeah, Gary Washburn writes this week.
Do you think it's fair to call him fragile?
Now, my mom said this, and you're a guy from a medical background, too. There might be a little something with the bones there. I mean, like the way you break a hand catching a pass, you break your ankle going, it's just dumb luck, maybe. I don't know. I'm not a doctor. You got to tell me here. He's had some freak injuries. It's unreal. Yeah. Like he just suffered a grade 3 ankle sprain with nerve damage, apparently, just off kind of stepping awkwardly in the lane. It's unfathomable. And again, you can't rip them for that. The contract didn't go the way they thought, and there's been all the adverse effects of that. So what do you kind of just throw your hands up and say, what the heck? They never could have predicted this. He never had these issues in Utah. It just all kind of started with that freak night in Cleveland.
He's a likable player the way Evan Turner was an extremely likable player.
Yeah, come on. Now,
well, no. Here's on the court. Okay, not as a person, right? Evan was exciting, right? Like funny.
No, I mean their production. Evan shot 11% from three. Gordon had a 40% three-point shooting this year.
But what I mean is willing to take that, you know, side role, facilitate it, pass, you know, there were some things that I thought Evan Turner did a really good job of, you know, and I'm not trying to like compare them like they're on the same level.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that there were some similar things about the unselfishness, do whatever's asked of me, you know, and you're right. Evan couldn't shoot a 3-pointer, but he did a lot in the zone. He did a lot in that space. You know what I mean? In the mid range.
Yeah.
And I feel like that even when Hayward came back and he wasn't even whatever, I think it was really obvious how much he's able to probe that area, you know, and keep it dangerous. Even when he's, you know, I know he missed that layup and everybody was flipping out. There's a lot of reasons to like Gordon Hayward. There's just a lot of reasons not to like his contract based on, you know, his availability. I mean, and you look at the fan base and everybody's just, you know, you can't tell me that this team's better off without Gordon Hayward. That's ridiculous, which is true. They're not better off without Gordon.
Well, it taught me a lesson because when I was growing up, I thought Joe Johnson was the biggest fraud because he was making as much money as anyone in Brooklyn, or Atlanta too, for that matter. Yep. They had the most mediocre teams. And I'm like, what's wrong with this guy? But you start to see when the cap goes up and guys are available, the money just keeps going up, and it doesn't really matter who it is because everyone's going to get paid. And then once you reach that level, the expectations go through the roof. It's been tough because I look at
it. But he was worth that contract.
He was, yeah. For this year, he was on all-star production level going into
right
that broken hand.
Yeah, right before he got hurt, yep.
Yeah, and then he comes back again, rock solid. I thought in the bubble especially, he was fantastic. And then you get into the postseason and it happens again. So now, you look, there's probably one more year for him to try
when
to recover
healthy,
and bounce back.
When he's, you know, conditioned and healthy, he's absolutely worth the money. There's no doubt, especially the way that he's willing to sacrifice for the other guys around him and make those players better when he's out there without getting in their way. There's just no doubt. He has a great impact. He's worth it.
Yeah.
But I don't think, you know, he's going to pick up his player option because he'd be an idiot not to.
So they have one.
And there's no way he comes back after that.
So this is it right here. And I stress this because they lose here in the East Finals to the Heat. You have the future, Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown. That's going to go on and on and on, you hope. But there's always this window of opportunity that goes limitless. But honestly, I look at them, Kemba Walker and his knee issues that may or may not go forward, Hayward and his health going into the next year. Next year's the year. I mean, what the Celtics established themselves as this year in the bubble that made me think that they were going to be a championship contender during those regular season games is they had four scorers that no other team could match. You lose one of those in Hayward, the whole thing kind of comes tumbling down. So Marcus Smart jumps into that Hayward spot, and I thought he did an admirable job. Now, is there a conflict a little bit offensively between his shot selection and the others on the team and his ball handling versus who needs the ball on the team? Yeah, but he's filling in that Hayward role, and he's not necessarily Hayward. So there's going to be a downtrend.
He needs to be the primary ball handler. That's why he works so well coming off the bench. And he is looking to make more plays. The issue was that the Celtics weren't really making buckets. I mean, the offense looked miserable. And Marcus is more than willing to be the guy to try to go grit out some offense. The problem is sometimes he tries to grit it out from beyond the arc a little bit too much once he gets hot. Yep. Like he almost gets a big head. It's like if we could just – it's not that he gets a big head. He just gets carried away because he's a passionate guy. And it's like if we could just not take away the passion, just be like, dude, I get it that you hit a bunch of three-pointers, you know, but – you got to mix it up more. You got to attack. But here's the thing. Yeah, I hear you saying the window this year, next year, whatever. I'm kind of like, meh on that, to be honest with you. I mean, do I want it? Yeah, I want it. But I'm, but I said, you know, what was it? I guess we're coming up on at least a year and a half ago, if not 2 years ago, with all that, you know, talk about trying to trade for Anthony Davis, you know, and giving up Tatum. I'm like, nah. I want to play the long game. I mean, was
fair point.
I'm pissed about the way this went down. So don't get me wrong on my level of patience right now because I had a couple of days to cool off.
Yeah.
But I didn't even
watch. This is Justin 3 days later, if you're wondering.
Dude, I did not even watch game five. Friday night, I was hanging out with a buddy at my camper. Having some
you gave up.
Yeah. I was like, well, I knew it was over.
We did a whole segment.
We knew it was over.
The first quarter of that game when it was really going bad, we sent our text messages through. Or no, we showed everybody our text messages from that first quarter, and we weren't too far from you.
I was watching it on Twitter. I like pulled it up a couple of times.
Oh, it was bad.
Sucks. And I was like, all right, you know, but then, you know, but you could see it was headed this way, and we could talk about a couple of that things around that in general. I was big on the long game.
Let's start with Brad Stevens then. So okay. we talk about Doc, and I find it interesting because you said he can control the room. He doesn't necessarily have the game down. Stevens has the game down, but his approach to the team, for right or wrong, I don't think this is necessarily wrong in today's league. Is that it?
Not old enough, didn't play.
I don't think that's it. I think he looks at the NBA right now and says it's a players' league. They're going to do what they want. They're going to tune you out if you try to change that. So I'm going to appease them. And look at what it did for Marcus Smart. Hate it or love it, I think his approach was smart, made Smart a better player, allowed him to be fearless, allowed him to develop his three. Jaylen Brown comes in, not a great shooter, gets a bunch of attempts to work it out. Now he's the best corner three-point shooter in the league. Now, does it get carried away in certain circumstances? Does the analytics that he follows...
More Smart than Jaylen.
Yep.
Jaylen just fades in the corner and doesn't... Sometimes he just doesn't get involved enough.
That's the tough thing about this.
But it's not. Right now. But it's not because he overdoes it. I never feel like Jaylen. If anything, my criticism of Marcus is that he overasserts himself and on offense, and I had no criticism on him overasserting on defense.
No,
either of those players, honestly, on offense. Marcus overasserts himself sometimes, and Jaylen underasserts himself sometimes. And I don't mean under asserts from a shooting three-pointer standpoint. I mean just attacking. And when you look at how they were able to kind of like keep climbing back into the series if they got down in a game, or if you, you know, look at one of their wins, and I guess it even goes to Toronto, but it really played out in Miami, as soon as Jalen got aggressive and like really tried to attack the rim, it made a big difference. I mean, it made a really big difference in how they were able to
get. I love it. Yeah. And he's capable of it too. With the ball handling he's developed, and just his overall ability to get to the rim, he's the best driver on the team. And he takes 30 shots in that pivotal, I think it was the game 5 against Toronto. Some people got on him a little bit about that. I think he only hit 11. But I'm like, when this guy's forcing the issue, and I think the stats to back it up, I don't have them on hand, when he is scoring 25-plus, I believe their record's impeccable, if not undefeated.
They're a small team. A small team. You know, Bam definitely exploited that. It made it tough on them. And if they don't attack aggressively on offense, it makes it worse.
So somehow, some way, you have to flip Brown into a position where every game he's on the ball, he's a priority for the offense. And I think the rotation being where you want it to be helps shake that out a little bit. The question is this team conducive to staying healthy when it comes to Kemba's knee? Smart, Hayward.
So I'm glad you mentioned Kemba, because I feel like Kemba's in the way a little bit, you know, with what you just said about Brown, you know, especially when Hayward's not in the lineup. You know, when Hayward's in the lineup, that works a little bit more smoothly.
Yeah.
But Smart can't be just completely off the ball because he's uninvolved in the offense. So then they've got to kind of get the ball to Kemba. Smart's kind of has to have the ball. And then, so when does Jalen get the ball not in the corner to do the things you just described? Now, imagine this long game I'm talking about when you have Robert Williams who – you know,
you buying in? This is the summer.
Stay healthy.
This is the summer of complicated feelings about Rob.
No, I love Rob. I mean, just the athleticism. He's got a lot of.
So why was Brad so hesitant to play him? I think there's two things there.
I don't know why Brad was so excited to play Tice, to be honest with you. I mean, yeah, he finished it out well, and I get that he's there. But, dude, everything that made Tice good on offense was his ability to create space for Tatum to weave through the lane. Mm-hmm. All those little picks.
And that shit
went away game 3 in Toronto. And as soon as it did, and it was so funny because at the beginning of that series, they were like, oh, look at all, and even against Philly, look at all the little things Tice does to create space. And
I wrote an article about that.
Yeah, everybody was talking about it. But then, just like you said, it was gone. And, man, the minute that was gone, Grant Williams became their best center, at least in the Miami series.
It always depended, though.
Yep.
Some games it'd be Grant. Some games Cantor looked like the answer. Some games Rob looked like the answer. His Toronto spurts in that series were phenomenal. And it looked like, you know, I started saying against Philly, if this guy can turn it up, this changes the team completely.
It's just
it
a
gives
little
them
slow on
need.
Rotations on D. Just, I mean.
The Ibaka thing killed him.
Yeah. And I think he's so young. He's going to get so much better. He really is. Like, 2 more years and it's going to be outstanding. But, you know, I'm looking at a time when it's going to be, you know, Smart's the distributor, doesn't force as much. Jalen gets the ball in his hands a little bit more so he can do the attacking that you're talking about. Tatum, one thing that was definitely a major upside is Tatum learned how to create for others like better than he ever has in these last 2 series, because Toronto and Miami did an awesome job. And, you know, don't get me started about the officiating, because I really did not. it goes back to game 3 in Toronto.
Yeah.
That's another, like, right around the time Tice disappeared, you know, they started letting the opponent, you know, grab Jason Tatum beyond the arc as soon as he got the ball. They're grabbing, clutching, doing all this. And, you know, he's not getting a call, and he shouldn't be throwing his arms up in the air, and his body language was poor. But they were letting the opponents grab and clutch him and really just disturb that. But then he finally gets freed up. How many times did he get called for pushing off with his arm?
Yeah.
I'm like, well, hold on a second. But why? Because maybe it was a little bit extra. Like, we allow this in the league. We just only allow it to a certain subjective level. I mean, dude, that's baloney. That was one of the most frustrating things, the way that they were calling that. I watched Jimmy Butler push off.
I will say Tatum got his free throws, though.
Yeah.
He did. He had quite a few 10 free throw games in the playoffs. I think the whistle was fair on him. I thought he was phenomenal in the playoffs. Now, I try to push back a little bit against it because I think especially after game 7, they were saying, oh, here's the new savior. Here's the new, like, best player in the league. And I think he still has a few more steps to take to get to that position, which is fair. He's 22. He's going to have the opportunity to get
but
there.
But he averaged like a double-double.
The turnovers, though. The turnovers that came with it killed them, especially in these late game situations.
See, that's my point about the whole like they let the opponent be extremely physical with him. But then if you look at the Celtics, they were not getting away with that. They were constantly in foul trouble. You know,
the war on Tice.
Yeah, it wasn't equal, dude. It was not equal. And I don't know if the criticism, if I have any for the Celtics, is that they should have forced the foul trouble issue every game. And I've always said that.
They did it in game 5 against Miami, and then next game, gone again.
They didn't. And you've got to make the officials look bad. It's the only way to win that war. Not with your hands up, not with your mouth. It's keep fouling. Make them foul everybody out, you know, because then they're going to be like, well, we can't have these are the stars.
Let's go back to Brad. Brad's not a guy who's ever going to press the issue on that. No, he's always going to say, I said that against Toronto too. It's part of, I hate it, but it's part of the game. Nick Nurse did it and he wouldn't. And there was some animosity there between Nick Nurse and Brad Stevens in series. Like they were two different kinds of coaches.
Dude, the minute Nick Nurse was in the corner calling for a pass, you know, like
that was the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. I've never seen any coach do that. You've called the NBA longer than me. Have you ever seen a coach do that?
I've never seen anything like it.
That's like a college coach antics right there.
Dude, you just can't, first off, you can't be on the court, but you really shouldn't be in the corner like that. And like literally he gets the pass. You know, it's like, I don't know why you'd ever
think
that
series was infuriating. And I like Toronto. I became the Toronto fan on the post game show because I showed them a lot of respect. I said this series is going to go longer than people think, especially when it got to 2-0. But man, were they infuriating! They had that edge of the champion. They had that coach who was going to do whatever it took, and they made it out of this series by this much.
It took a lot out of the Celtics. Yep. By the time the Celtics made it to the Miami series, all that clutching and grabbing and, you know,
it's another issue with Boston. You didn't have the bench to allow the rest for that.
Yeah. Yep. But that's why you got to force the issue. You have to, like, when you realize it's getting that way, you who gives a crap if everybody's got 4 fouls? You know, as a matter of fact, one thing Brad did do, who had 4 fouls and he didn't pull them?
He did that all the time. So it's tough to.
That's the one thing I was.
Tice had 4, and then Kemba. Kemba in game 6 as well.
Yes, that's right. I knew there was 2. So, you know, I think he did pick Kemba up out of the game, not right away, but not long. But Tice, he just left out.
He got a little uncertain, with the rotations. And I thought that it was so fitting how this team season ended. Tice just gets boom, boom, 5th foul, 6th foul, right out of the game. There's 3 minutes left. I think it's tied or they're down 3 at that point. And he's like, do I go Grant? He puts Grant in, gets a little uncertain about it. Goes with his best 5. Hayward's hobbled, of course, and then they just get run off the court because they couldn't figure out their center position. Now I'm higher on Tice than you, but you saw the limitations of Tice.
I've been high on Tice all season.
You saw, like, the limitations
all season,
of him,
but yeah, that's why you got to be a little more on the long game with like a Rob Williams, because he's got the like superior athleticism. I don't know that he's ever going to be. Like, Bam is strong, right? And I don't know that Rob's ever going to be like...
Bam is special.
Nah. Yeah.
That guy, we talk, you look at Tatum and you say, this guy's a Hall of Famer. I see that with Bam, too. He is...
Yeah, he had a lot more polish to his game than I expected.
He can run the offense like Al Horford did, and this guy is... Like, Al Horford started doing that in, like, 9, 10 years into his career. Yeah, this guy's like
23. Yeah.
This guy's been playing for 2 years with Miami, and that's what killed Tyson this too. Against Toronto, he just had a sprint back and catch them in transition, but now he's trying to guard Bam and follow the passes. Like, it discombobulated Boston, but I don't think any center could have won that matchup. Like, even
what did Boston shoot from 3? Do you know in that series?
They shot so many that it diluted it.
That's what I mean. I didn't feel like it was really that great. I felt like, the spacing was an issue.
Yeah, when Tice was out there in particular, because his three-point shooting fell apart. But, you know, how do you feel about Brad? Everybody's like,
should he get fired?
We can start there. No. But do we both agree on no?
No. I don't think Brad's going
All right,
going
so what's
anywhere.
The next step?
They just signed him.
Yeah.
I think he should stick around. I think that the in large in part, the team is young. And they're not going to get some calls, and they still have a lot to learn. So I just don't see where I think he's got rope, man. I think he's got rope, and I think he's got the respect of the players. I think that's the biggest thing. Do I think he deserves some heat? No, not yet. Not major heat. I mean, everybody's up for criticism. But does he deserve major heat? No. No, because – he's already taken underperforming teams and brought them up.
Yeah.
He's taken a super young team with a cancer and, you know, didn't get him to the Eastern Conference Finals that year. But, you know, Eastern Conference Finals, young club, lots of turnover. Before we even started recording, you and I almost did the podcast before we even hit record.
Yeah.
But the thing we were going to say was, well,
the greatest sin in podcasting.
This team? Yeah, the greatest sin. What was the expectations for this team at the beginning of the year? You know, and once Kyrie was gone and everything else, I mean, they were like, well, middle of the pack team, da 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 da. They almost went to the finals. I mean, in large in part, they exceeded expectations from the beginning of the season. They may not have exceeded the expectations that we had for them in the bubble or, you know, at the point where the season was shut down where we thought we were at. But let's be honest. When they shut down the season, it was the best thing that could have happened to this team because
they were so injured,
faltering. Yes. So I think they exceeded expectations. I don't think you can kill Brad. I think you're going to want to see year-over-year incremental improvement, and that incremental improvement has to come from the players that are here year after year, not from roster turnover, changes, trades.
Didn't think we'd say this, but it echoed some of what we saw in 2019 and that he's going to do the best with the team you give him, but you got to give him the right team.
Yeah.
I think this is where you pull Ainge in, who hasn't gotten talked about enough this week. I give him some leeway because the team he drafted last year, as we know, the draft comes before free agency, so he probably doesn't know they're getting Kemba, definitely doesn't know how good the team was going to be. So you basically had two halves of the team, a half that was ready to contend once Kemba comes along, and then these draft picks that, you know, I like Grant Williams, but Romeo Langford, Carson Edwards, even my guy Tremont Waters, they weren't ready to contribute to this team.
But yeah, they're fun guys, but they're, yeah, 100%.
The underbelly of this team was so young, so raw, so far away from helping them. Even a semi-Ojale couldn't do much. Brad Wanamaker was about the only bench guy that they could get to chip in a little bit, and even he was teetering on edge most of the time. So Brad did the best with that situation. Wanamaker led the bubble in plus minus for those 8 games. So he made the best of this. It's just the underbelly of the team needed some help. Maybe you look back to last draft. Maybe you look back to the trade deadline. But I think Ainge probably didn't do the best job he could have with maximizing this roster this year.
I still don't know how much money he has to play with. You know, that's the other thing. You know, he's going to have to spin picks off for players, and those players come with salaries, and there's a salary cap, and he had to extend Jaylen Brown. Good job, he did. But now they're going to have to pay Tatum, and they're still paying Hayward, and they just signed Walker. Like, they don't have a lot of money to work with here. And so I think that we exceeded Ainge's expectations this year just as much as we exceeded, you know, the expectations the fan base had and the national media had at the beginning of the year. I think there's definitely an angle here where Ainge is trying to, you know, get some of these rookies and figure out who could pay off by year 4 of that contract, right, and really help them out. But I'm not sure that he thought he was building a championship club for this season as much as, you know, he was going to get the locker room culture fixed, You know, he was going to solidify guys like Brown, who probably wouldn't have stuck around if Kyrie did. You know, I mean, that could have gotten really messy. You know, he re-signs, you know, the guys who are 100% going to build this team into the future. And he's got, what, three more picks this year? So they'll be able to, like, play around with all of that. And, you know, like, Grant's got a spot on this team the next 4 years.
Good pick. Good pick.
Should he be a starting center? You know, should he be the guy you're relying on instead of Tice? No, of course not. But he's only got so much money to play with. And so I wonder how much he's – I mean, think about it. They won a championship, and Big Baby was a solid – and Leon Poe were solid minute contributors off the bench.
Sometimes you get lucky with those second-round picks, which they certainly did there. I mean, Davis was a throw-in.
But they had the talent.
Yeah.
They had Posey and they had
And
House.
I think this Those team has the talent. Yeah. And that's my point with this team. I felt good about them when they were fully healthy and they had everybody in their place.
You know what they didn't have?
What?
They didn't have a Kendrick Perkins. And when the Celtics got rid of Perkins for Green.
Perkins is available.
They were soft in the middle. Yeah. Yes, he is. He's gonna stay that way.
Everybody wants a center. You know what? I'll concede it a little bit after seeing that Miami series. They need some help in there, but you're right. Rob, they're leaning on Rob and in the future. Do you feel great about that? I don't know. I think the talent's there. I just don't know if the room for improvement is there in him. Although he did get better this year, minimally, I'd say.
All he has to do is figure out how to play good position defense because he can alter shots. You know, he just, it's the reaction time. It's the speed of the game.
Yeah.
The bigger concern has always been, can he stay healthy? But
that's a big one. I mean, he missed 50 games in a row this year, right?
Yeah.
Something like that with the hip. That was
He's going to have to be able to stay healthy. And if he can do that on offense, he can create a lot of easy buckets. You know, he could get, he worked the pick and roll a lot, you know, maybe not always smooth, but.
He would come in and score like 10 points in 5 minutes too at his best. Like it was remarkable.
And, you know, they don't lose anything. Once he gets his rotations down, they're not going to lose anything with that positionless defense of theirs because he's so long and he's quick enough that he can really close out on those better shooters. He's just got to get that half step faster because he anticipates. He doesn't have any real anticipation right now. All of his blocks are recovery blocks. He got beat. He got beat, and he found a way to use his athleticism not to get yanked off the floor.
All right. Justin Poulin, Dome Theory, you're the guest. I'm going to let you swing this in two directions right here. Do you want to talk about the finals, or do you want to look back on the season, share some of your favorite memories? You pick.
Oh, you want me to talk about Rondo winning two championships, one with the Celtics and one with the Lakers. Let's do finals. No, I'm just saying, if he wins, what was that tweet? If the Lakers win the finals, he'll be the first player in history to win the finals with the Celtics.
So Nick talked to me about this. Nick Gelso, coaches have done it, players have not. So Rondo would be the first player to do it.
Nah. Well, all right, let's do the finals. Let's do the finals.
I think the Heat can win. I've been trying to convince myself of this of the last couple of days.
Nope. They want to all go home. The Heat get swept by the Lakers.
Wow. All right. So let me do my best here. They have a good zone. It's not a great zone. It's a good zone. They have the right personnel in there. I don't think the fundamentals are sound, which made it all the more frustrating that the Celtics couldn't figure it out. But the pieces in there, long wings, being able to hide those different shooters in there a little bit, and then Bam in the center, blowing up pick and rolls against it. Their defense is legit. And then they can throw in man situations Crowder, Iguodala, and Jimmy Butler at LeBron. They have the right personnel defensively to make it tough on LA. And Bam, man, you've seen some of the struggles Davis has had when it got a little physical out there. Bam's going to make it tough on Davis. This isn't a sweep at the very least.
I think it's a sweep.
Just a LeBron and Davis thing? Because
it's a great excuse for everybody to go home.
All right.
It's going to be low ratings, dude. It's going to be a very.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, the whole thing's been low ratings.
And it's going to bottom out right now. Like the league seemed to want Miami, you know, like if you're.
All right. Is this just a Celtics thing? Would the ratings have been high for the Celtics?
I think the ratings would have been higher for Celtics Lakers. I do. But I feel like the Miami underdog thing, you know, so you never know. Right. The Miami getting to Toronto last year, Miami this year would be a pretty incredible story when you consider that Kawhi went from, you know, east to west and all of that. So it would be a great story for Miami to win. There's no doubt. How favored are the Lakers? I mean, I know they've got to be favored. How favored are they?
They're 4.5 in game one. And I think it's like 350, 285 on the odds. So they're not heavy. Huge favorites, but they're hefty favorites. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not surprised because I would definitely, part of the reason I have them as a sweep candidate is because of what you just said. Like, there are a lot of soft spots in that Miami defense when they bring their shooters out. And the players that are going to have to take on Davis and LeBron are not going to be able to make the big plays. But LA still has other good defenders, right? Like Rondo's going to be able to play some solid defense on any of those shooters. And they also have guys that will make some plays away from LeBron and away from Anthony Davis that I feel like even if Miami throws everything at those two guys and makes it tough, I just think it's going to leave everything else wide open because Tyler Hero, you know what I mean? Like Duncan, those guys are going to be,
Celtics look at the Lakers
screwed up not attacking those players more.
It's tough against his. People talk about a zone like it's so easy to solve. And one thing the zone can do is minimize the weaknesses of those two guys specifically and help them contribute to the offense. And they need some offensive help. They're going to need to get in transition. Their half-court offense isn't great as we saw against the Celtics. So they have some things they're going to have to overcome, namely playing two of the top five players in the NBA. They don't have close to that top-end talent on their side, but I think they have coaching. I think they have scheme. I think they have depth, and I think they have some good wing defenders to throw out there and a great center to go against Davis.
Yeah, and I like Spoelstra. I mean, I definitely – you got to take your hat off to that guy. I mean,
yeah.
He's an institution. And he's kind of under the radar, right? Isn't it weird how under the radar he is?
Well, they had some shaky years the last few years after LeBron left, and part of that was Chris Bosh having to retire. They traded Dwayne Wade. They kind of broke the thing up. They signed some dumb contracts, Hassan Whiteside, Deion Waiters.
I was going to say Deion
James
Waiters.
Johnson. Yep. So they kind of pulled this out of their butt to some degree with some of the trades they made. And then, of course, getting all the, I mean, you run into Tyler Hero, Bam in the mid-round, Duncan in unrestricted or undrafted free agency. They ran into some gold all at the same time, which is pretty remarkable. I think a tribute to their organization. I'm not wearing the Heat culture hat, but there's a little of that there. So I think they'll put up a fight. You're probably right. The Lakers probably win this. They have LeBron. They have the team.
It's almost always the team with the best players.
Yeah.
You know, and there's an argument to be made, and you made it already. You know, you said Bam was right there with Jason and probably was the better player in the series, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, you called that there, but usually the team with the best, you know, top two or three players, you know, wins the series. And it's an appreciable difference. You make a good point. Bam's defense on Davis, we'll have to see how that plays out because if Davis isn't effective, you know.
Davis needs to play center here.
That's going
to
be a problem.
Yeah. This is me being biased a little bit here. I looked at this Lakers team coming in this year and said, I hate
Dwight Howard, dude.
I don't see it.
I hate Dwight Howard.
KCP. Rondo has impressed me, frankly. Mm-hmm. But everybody else there, I look at their cast of role players, Kyle Kuzma, I'm just like, they don't have enough. But those two players, LeBron, Davis, kept getting it done over and over again. So they're probably going to prove me wrong one last time.
Yeah. By the way, maybe we end on this one. Doesn't Doesn't Rondo look like he aged overnight? Like he went from perennially looking like the young, like he didn't look like he was ever going to age, right? Like he was just this young baby face. And then, and I don't know if it's the dew, but like literally overnight, it's like he's got wrinkles and he looks like the oldest man. It's like he was using some miracle, you know, like face cream. And then because of COVID, they stopped supplying it.
All right, that's one like, theory.
We went from a grape to a raisin overnight.
I heard people talking, they couldn't get their skincare routines down. I could definitely see Rondo being a skincare guy. The Amazon orders were backed up. I'll also say, this guy's been to so many different cities now. It's unreal. Like, how many times has this guy had to move? They used to have that Photoshop of Shaq and the rainbow of jerseys. That became Rondo by the end of his career.
For real. Which is weird because it seemed like he was going to be the player the Celtics were going to rely on in the post-KG Paul Pierce era.
Yeah, some of us thought that, and we were so wrong.
Yeah, that ended fast. That ended faster than the Antoine Walker era under Ainge.
That brings me back. This is a perfect spot to end. Thank you, Jay Crowder. That's all the reason you need to root for the Heat. And not every Celtics fan will feel that way, but I feel that way. I'd love to see Jay Crowder, Kelly Olynyk holding on to the trophy.
Ugh.
not Justin.
Not every Justin, Celtics fan.
Justin Poulin, Celtics Stuff Live every week with John Duke. Say hi to John for me. Love that guy. Thank you guys for everything you've done over the last couple of years, helping me out here and teaching me the ways and just supporting me too. I really appreciate it.
Likewise, man. You've been there for us. And, you know, thanks for having me on to close out the season. Really appreciate it. And we'll do it anytime. And who knows when we start this baby back up again. So would be happy to kick it all off when the season gets underway.
All right. Thank you, Justin Poulin. We move on to our next segment with my experts here, Rocco Simino, our old friend Lindo Zay. Welcome back, Lindo. It's been like a year since we talked to you here on Dome Theory.
I know. It's been quite a while.
Well, we have quite the occasion here. Rocco was on the show last when we did our incomplete top 50 Drake songs. I think we did top 25 when you were on there last, and things have changed on that front too, so we might have to do a re-up of that at some point.
Album since then.
And he's got another one coming soon. I'm not thrilled about it. What's it, Certified Lover Boy?
I am so out of the loop on that stuff now, I couldn't tell you.
All right. We'll circle back when Drake shows his face again. For now, we have the debate, which everyone was thrilled about. I think we all started watching and our mouths just collectively dropped and we're like, what's happening here? And we knew it was going to be crazy. We knew it was going to be something unexpected happening here, but I think it was even wilder than anyone could have imagined. It was nonstop interrupting the whole time. There were probably one, maybe two clear segments that came through and shined for the policy and nuances between the two, but otherwise it was just shut up. Hunter Biden, like the lowest possible topical themes came out. And man, I got to start with this, Lindo. Chris Wallace, I gave him so much credit when he did the interview with Trump. I thought it was the best interview with Trump anyone had done in 4 years. And all of a sudden he comes out here. I'm expecting him to do pretty good off that. And it was a disaster. He had no control. He didn't know what to do.
Yeah, you'd think that he had a little bit more – Trump would have a little bit more respect for Chris after the way he kind of alluded to it.
No.
And giving him a one-on-one. And following that, just like you said, I thought, you know, Chris Wallace is going to have that skill to rein in Trump. And, oh, my goodness, it was like a schoolyard fight with a substitute teacher attempting to stop them. They couldn't stop him in any way, shape, or form. Chris Wallace was the moderator, and Trump was asking questions. It was really horrific, and I too was expecting it to be, you know, a quality guy stepping in when he needed to, and Trump really ran the entire debate. Whether or not he answered any questions legitimately, you know, you could say whatever you want on that, but it's clear he ran the whole debate.
What the hell, Rocco? What do you even say?
I don't know. I mean, I think we kind of should have expected this from Trump. I mean, he's always had the short temper. He's the definition of toxic masculinity. And now, for the first time since he's been in office, he's in an environment where someone has a large position of authority over him. This is the first time he's kind of had to cede authority, cede being the one running the show, even though, I mean, he clearly didn't really do that. But this, again, was the first time and will be the last time outside of debates.
You're talking Wallace or Biden?
Trump.
No, who had the authority over him?
Wallace as the moderator.
Oh, okay.
You could see Trump's insecurity started flaring up almost instantly.
Yeah, and Wallace did what he could, I felt like. Like, he tried joking around. He tried shutting him down. He tried repeating himself over and over again. Nothing worked. It was crazy. And Biden's response to it wasn't great either, I felt like. The scariest thing for me out of last night is it seemed to foreshadow how limited the rules are going to be in trying to prevent Trump from doing whatever he wants come November, because Biden just kind of sat back expecting the rules of the debate, the moderator to carry him through when Trump was acting crazy, and it couldn't save him. So a lot of times Trump was going off the rails and Biden was just sitting back.
Well, it clearly to me looked like that was part of Trump's strategy. Every single time, if you go back and watch, every single time that Biden starts going in on a really big talking point for his side that makes Trump look bad, that is when Trump starts to interject and starts to talk over him. It kind of just seemed like his entire strategy, instead of taking on what Biden's actually saying, he just wanted to talk over him and try to completely make sure nobody at home can hear what's going on.
Well, it was such a disgrace. And five minutes in, it happened twice. And I'm like, all right, they got to shut this down. Like, this just can't happen. They came in, they agreed to these rules. And Trump just started completely disparaging the rules, like two segments in. And I'm like, all right, if they're not going to end this one, Lindo, they probably shouldn't do another debate in my eyes.
I agree. And I initially wanted to see it as much as possible, but it was entertaining.
I was excited, yeah.
It was so bad for politics in general, which, you know, it was already in a, you know, downward spiral, but it's so bad because at least in 2016, like or dislike Hillary Clinton, people could look on and say, you know, at least that's a legitimate person.
Those debates were better. Maybe I'm imagining it wrong, but I remember those being a little better than this. Maybe not much better.
I think Hillary Clinton was the decided winner in the debates. And, you know, that was, you could probably go back and look up articles from that time of people saying, oh, it's over. She destroyed him. He didn't have anything. And Trump really saw that as, you know, a victory since he won after that, and thought, okay, let me just do the same thing this time, but the entire duration of the debates. So every time, like Rocco had said, every time he started speaking, okay, let me start just derailing whatever it's in. I can't recall a single policy that Trump brought up during the entire hour and a half, maybe sending in the National Guard, although that's not really policy, just an action. I can't remember a policy he stated. It was simply just a personality battle and personal and family attacks from Trump, and Joe Biden laughing off remarks, saying, shut up, man, calling him a clown. It was ridiculous. If there is another one, now we know what to expect, although I don't know that Joe Biden will be aptly prepped for it, because how do you prep for Donald Trump? You really can't. So I think it's, you know, it's not really worth it. I'd much rather wait for the Kamala Pence debate next week.
Thank God. So, Rocco, this is what disturbed me too out of yesterday. It's like five things that disturbed me. The pre-shows, the post-shows, just gushing over Biden and his performance and his demeanor and just how presidential he looked. And there's still this thing in the political media where I think these veterans, like whether it be Chris Matthews or anybody else, Chris Matthews, of course, isn't around anymore because of this, they have this ho-hum attitude about politics and, you know, kissing the babies and just like all this old tradition of politics that's clearly gone. So they see Biden up there handling the attacks well, you know, deflecting the Hunter Biden stuff and just telling them to shut up. And they seem to think that was more effective than I did, because I just see him getting lambasted through everything he was trying to say. And they're like, oh, people are going to see Trump doing that and they're going to take notice. And I don't think that's how his supporters especially are going to react to that. And people who are even sympathetic to him are probably just going to say, oh, yeah, that's just the way he is. But, you know, it's for good reason. Like, did you come out of that feeling as good about Biden as some of the political commentators seem to?
Yeah, I don't think Biden did anything himself that really elevated his status, but it's just the way that Trump imploded.
Oh, so you agree. It was a disaster for him that you think will have some impact.
For pretty much the first 30 minutes, it was Trump's debate. Like, he was absolutely dominating Biden in every single facet. And then I don't know exactly what minute this happened, but in my eyes, once Biden made the injecting bleach comment, that it was over for Trump after that. As soon as Biden said that, I felt like Trump just went completely off
the cliff. It was sarcasm.
What do you mean over for Trump?
Trump's general demeanor. And so he had already been interrupting up to that point, but I felt like after that, it not only got worse, but the way that Trump was just handling questions and in general handling what he was saying completely got derailed. I'd say in the first 30 minutes, especially in the first segment, I thought Trump was coming off as very, very presidential. He seemed very composed at first. He was talking very politely. And I thought
relatively,
that was the way of the debate. I thought we're all sitting at home. We're expecting Trump's going to come out here. Trump's going to implode. He's going to attack Biden like there's no tomorrow. And then on the first few questions, he comes off as a regular president, like articulate. He's talking about his points well. And it just slowly started getting worse from there. And then I felt like once Biden made the injecting bleach comment is when Trump really just lost all sense of composure.
Well, to me, saying that, of course he did, but saying it's over, I don't see it as that. Maybe that's just a semantic battle. But as soon as he did that, I'm sure once he went going crazy, I think his supporters were like, wow, this is exactly what we want. We don't want a guy who's going to talk about policy. We want a guy who's going to just demean the other guy and make him seem like he's weak and a loser. And I think that's what, you know, Trump's goal was. And I think he succeeded. He did. He, you know, same way that he went in on Ted Cruz's wife and insulted her and then said, you know, his dad killed JFK. Same thing. Your son or my son who was in Iraq, and he was like, yeah, your son was discharged for cocaine use. So I don't think it was over. I think this is just regular Trump. And I think that's what people are going to see on both sides. They're going to say that's who Trump is when it's negative, and that's who Trump is when it's positive. So
that's I agree with you on that.
That's another spot I wish Wallace could have done something in, because I knew Hunter was going to come up. It's still such an aggravating topic to me. Like, it's just, it's the classic Trump conspiracy nonsense that gets to dominate this fashion. And I think Wallace did try to push back against it at one point. He's like, this isn't even the topic. But Trump had to get it in there. He had to do the Hunter Biden segment. I don't know how Biden could have pushed back better against it. I think he tried to shift it toward Bo, and that probably had some effectiveness, because you could loop in Trump's loser comments about the troops, which I think definitely hits him to some degree. But he didn't deflect that in the strongest way, which was tough for him, because, like you said, that had an impact on Cruz too.
Trump's biggest policy that he always recognizes is veterans' choice and how he's helping the vets, when that's really Obama era policy. So I'm sure whenever someone speaks about the veterans, Trump feels like that's the only thing I have, that and the economy. And if the economy is doing well, then I only have the vets. So.
Yeah. And the strongest point Trump made all night, I think the truest thing he said amid probably 50 lies. I don't know. The over under on lies was 5.5 for Trump. I should have bet 10,000 on it. talking about the tax bombshell that came out last week, and, you know, shedding some truth that Obama Biden's administration wrote that tax code and gave some of the benefits that allowed Trump to do what he ultimately did. And 95% of it was legal. Maybe there's something about the Atlantic City situation that, and the refund that he's under audit for, that it will end up being illegal out of that. But counting losses, getting that money back, paying $750, that was part of those Obama stimulus era tax cuts that I didn't love. I don't think it was good economics, but I think Trump made the best point of the night on his end that Obama Biden wrote the law that allowed him to do that. And it's like the crime bill. It's these certain things that Biden did that he doesn't have a strong defense for.
Well, not only that, but I think Trump deflected well there because he also brought up that Biden was going to raise the taxes. Like, once Biden started talking about how he was going to raise taxes, Trump just kind of let him keep talking. And I personally think if you're trying to win over undecided voters, the last thing you want to be doing is saying that you're raising taxes.
Yeah, which I hate.
I'm kind of perplexed at even the real discussion of that topic, because it doesn't really, I think that point only really resonates on, you know, Twitter or, you know, Facebook or something. Because in reality, how many millionaires and billionaires are not paying taxes? Like, that's nothing.
Well, didn't it hit Mitt in 2012?
Say it again?
Didn't it hit Mitt Romney in 2012 pretty hard? And that's obviously a different world, but that was one of the big things that downed him, wasn't it?
Sure, but if we're talking about Donald Trump, are his taxes anywhere near the top 10 issues with Donald Trump? Like, are people really sitting at home like, I'm sure Donald Trump pays all his taxes? This is a guy who's been saying, I can't show my taxes for 5 years now because they're under audit. Like, no, was there really people genuinely at home thinking, you know, this point is really going to sway me whether I support Trump or I don't? I think if you look up any millionaire or billionaire and see what they're doing with their taxes, what their CPAs are working with, they're all trying to pay $0 in taxes. Everyone would pay $0 if they could. So that point to me doesn't really seem that strong. Of course, Trump's not paying taxes, but I'm sure neither are his donors. Neither are Democratic donors. None of these. So I think that $750, it's funny, but it doesn't really resonate with general people, I wouldn't think.
Well, the debt thing was the big one out of it. It's like, where's the debt? How's he gonna get that money accumulated when you can see that his finances are drained a little bit, that kind of stuff. It goes back to all the Russia stuff when there wasn't any clear connections to Russia in here, but just different actions he took to try to self-benefit himself as president. I think it shed some light on that.
But all of that is kind of a fundamental misunderstanding of taxes in general. And not only that, but just Trump's actual income statements. Like, just because Donald J. Trump, the person, is paying little in federal income taxes doesn't mean that his businesses aren't doing well. It doesn't mean that he's not paying other kinds of taxes. Doesn't mean he's not paying state taxes. It doesn't mean that he's not paying federal income taxes through his businesses. Like, there's dozens and dozens of ways to be gaming the tax code in order to save money. But the fact that Donald J. Trump, the individual, paid $750 in income taxes doesn't mean that his businesses aren't doing well. It doesn't mean that he has no money. It's just more of a talking point than anything.
Well, he did get the massive refund. So it's the idea of, you didn't put anything in and you're getting this huge refund. It's like, what the hell is that? And that's a big point of contention. That's where the audit comes from. That's where he could run into some criminal issues ultimately here. We know 4 years running that he probably won't. But, like, there were some things in there that were pretty damning for him. Now, ultimately, as Lindo says, is it going to matter? That's the kind of statement we come out of tonight asking, that we've been asking for 4 years. Because, honestly, even a moment as shocking as him telling people to go to the polls and watch people vote and the Proud Boys dog whistle and just the two most absurd things you could ever imagine a presidential candidate saying. Just this insisted leniency toward white nationalism, this idea he has in his head that these people support me. So I got to, whatever you want to say about him, some people get up in arms about calling him a racist, but he at least is very passive toward people you could consider racist, at the very least. So will that even matter? I come out of this saying, if that doesn't matter, nothing matters. Because that's what, when it came down to race, the violence, and then ultimately saying that, that's where I just tune out and I'm like, come on, what are we doing here?
I agree. That was not only the most damning moment of the night, but in terms of making the case that Trump is either a white supremacist or at the very least a sympathizer for them, that was the biggest piece of evidence that argument's going to get.
It's pretty crazy that the debate had 2 minutes about black people. And in the response for black people, Chris Wallace said, yeah, you don't even have to talk about that if you don't want to Trump.
That was
his name drop of the Proud Boys is also kind of crazy. I feel like there was no need. No one even mentioned them. He brought them.
I can't believe Wallace said that.
And then didn't even say I denounced them. Just said stand by. It was really that entire section made me just as a black person be like, I'm so uninterested in either of these people. It's so funny because they're both like, no, you're a racist. No, 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 you're a racist. No, you're a racist.
Yeah. That's where he missed rebuttals. And I don't know what he says about the crime bill. That's still the thing that plagues him the most. And that I don't even know what you would say about that. He could have said that Hillary Clinton said super predators because Trump starts saying, you said super predators, you said super predators. When it wasn't Biden, it was Clinton, but they still fall under the umbrella of the law. So it's not surprising to see Biden not even pull that out and try to correct him there.
Happened, I kind of thought, yes, he's wrong. That was Hillary Clinton. But that's kind of like – that's like if someone insults you on five things about how you're a terrible person and you're like, no, I did match my shoes with my shirt that day. Like you're taking out the least important part in correcting that.
Yeah, and that's probably why he didn't say it, yeah. Yeah, so he doesn't correct that. He doesn't correct Kellyanne Conway saying that the riots were good for Trump. Like he just missed certain clapbacks. Even when Trump started saying socialist, socialist, socialist – the easiest clapback you could have said there is you got the biggest corporate socialism check anyone could imagine.
Right.
But he doesn't even go in that direction. And that's why I like Biden. I think he has a decent chance at winning this thing because of the coalition he had. But he's so limited. He tries so hard to distance himself from the left that he's backpedaling against Trump, trying to push him into a position that's actually popular when it comes to climate change, when it comes to healthcare, but he's just twisting himself in the knot to try to position himself between the left and Trump and just cater to like three different groups. And it made the performance such a waffling one to me, Rocco.
Yeah, I agree. Speaking of that, I thought, honestly, personally, Trump's funniest moment of the night was when they were talking about healthcare. Biden says that he doesn't have a manifesto, and then Trump just slides in, you just lost the left.
And he hit that one hard all night.
I think Trump's funniest line was Joe Biden was finishing a statement and he was like, number one, number two. And then Trump tried to interrupt him and he goes, number three. And Trump goes, no, you're still on number two.
I missed that one.
He also said he supported the Green New Deal at one point, and then Trump's like, you support it? And then he's like, no, I don't, even though he like mentioned everything in there that he would have actually done, but he called it the Biden plan because he didn't want to support the Green New Deal. I mean, and that's just going to drive people on the left insane, watching him do that on the national stage. Does that matter, though, Linda? Because I get it. They don't want to get the socialist thing thrown on them, but they get it thrown on them anyway. And then the people on Twitter, the left, they go crazy because they see their Democratic candidate up there trying to distance himself from them as much as possible. So they're going to get yelled at for not voting, but that's the kind of representation they're going to get on the national stage. Do you think that matters all that much when it comes down to it?
Here's the thing. I think they already don't think that they're going to get much of the left. They're really going after just their strong part, which is just the moderates and moderate Republicans. Which is kind of weird because there's so many more votes to access on the left. He could even pull in Obama and pretend he's some sort of populist, even though he has a 40-year track record. He could even pretend and say, you know, I do want the Green New Deal. I do want what's best for the climate or whatever. And it would, take a hit, I think, minimally and gain him a lot more. Those kind of people on the left who are like, I hate this guy, but he's better than Trump. I think he keeps telling those people, no, I'm right here with Trump. I'm not with you at all. So I think they've already recognized they're not really going to win over too many people from the left. So you might as well just stick to your guns. We hate them just like the Republicans do.
Republican light. That's why you're lucky, Rocco. I got off libertarians being Republican light and the Democratic establishment is just trying to be just to the left of Republicans, just a little bit.
Them last night. I don't know if you heard it, but he pledged to be a president for Democrats and Republicans. I thought that was just such a weird line.
Yeah. I mean, this is the DNC that gave John Kasich more minutes at the convention than AOC. So it wasn't surprising to see any of that tonight. I do.
This is the DNC that ran Michael Bloomberg with a $1 billion campaign to derail the left as well.
Hey, Bloomberg did give those millions of dollars to get the people enfranchised in Florida, so I'll give him credit for that. Betting odds out of this one, I thought it was so funny. The big one coming in for me was, is there going to be a swear uttered during this? And it was hard to imagine there being one, but I was like, this is going to be so nuts. This is going to be so heated that there'll be a swear dropped in here somewhere. But I was surprised it was Trump dropping the stupid bastards line, which was so deceiving because it was Biden at a camp calling them stupid bastards, like tongue in cheek for not laughing at a joke or something. But Trump turned it into, you called the troops stupid bastards. So plus 125, the swear hits this debate. The tie, I would have gotten totally wrong. They wore some striped ties. It wasn't Trump's classic red one. So it would have definitely got that one wrong.
Bob, I don't know if you know this, but for events like these, there is a person whose sole job is to figure out what kind of tie the president should wear.
I was so what color was Biden's? I couldn't tell. It was like gray and navy, right?
I'm colorblind, so probably not the best one to ask, but I thought it was...
I felt colorblind looking at it.
I thought he was going for a racial unity message with a black and white striped tie.
Is that what it was, Linda? Was it black and white?
Oh, I don't know. Is that more a pitch to the Masons than to unity? I have no idea.
I don't know. They said blue, light blue, navy blue was... I couldn't even figure out some of these odds because I felt like that could have been the tie, but I also felt like it could have been black and white, which would have been plus 1,200. I know Trump's... I think it was navy blue. And red. Yeah, yep. Blue and red.
Party unity.
So that was plus 1,600. So some people made some serious money on that tie.
Did they both wear USA lapels? I don't remember. Do people still do that?
I couldn't tell.
They had them on.
Did either of them take sips of water? I don't think I saw them do it. Although that's not something
I would have loved to see Trump do the two-hand raccoon pose. That stuff is so funny.
Well, that's why Biden was the favorite to take the first sip of water, because I don't think Trump wanted to go for that again.
Well, you saw what he did at that rally, right? When he just drank the water through the glass. That's what he should have done. That would have won Trump the debate right there if he did that.
Go ahead. What did you say?
It was I got burned on a bad Biden prop. It was what will Biden say first? Scranton -210 or come on, man?
He didn't say come on, man, did he?
I know. I couldn't believe it. So I got completely burned. He said Scranton like three times too.
He said shut up, man, which doesn't fit. Yeah, didn't expect that one.
How you doing, man? Then he put his arms out like he would have given him a hug. That was hilarious too.
I would have taken the Scranton one. That actually seemed like an easy one. Trump didn't say drug test or sleepy. I knew he wasn't going to call him sleepy because he's a pee, but drug test didn't come up either, surprisingly.
He, what's it called? Right before the debate started, he sent out a campaign email calling Biden Jim Crow Joe. I don't know how many times he said that, but that was the first time that I saw it. I was totally expecting him to bust out Jim Crow Joe on stage.
No, he's so scared. He won't say these things to his opponent. Yeah. Did he ever call Hillary Crooked Hillary to her face, Linda?
I don't remember. I don't think he did.
He
did say the jail line, so close enough, but.
And then the other one, non-facts Trump will say over 5.5. That has to be the easiest bet you could ever imagine. Biden 1.5 even. I feel like he probably slipped into non-truths there at the very least. But that's a tough one to tell. Like, who's gonna judge that one? Fake news, China virus. I feel like Trump said fake news at some point tonight.
Fake news was the winner. I had China virus. I don't think he said it once.
You lost some money, Rock.
Plague
huh?
from China should have never been let in.
All right.
I hit a big one, which saved me. It was whether or not Biden would come out wearing a mask.
Did he?
Plus 150. No, he didn't.
Yeah, neither of them did. That would have been easy for Trump. I was actually going to parlay red tie and no mask for Trump. I thought that was a given, but...
He pulled it out of his jacket, though, right? You saw that moment? Mm-hmm. When he was like, I got it. I got my mask right here and put it... It was like the most propped thing I'd ever seen in my life, just right at the right moment. Oh, I have a mask right here, and then put it right back away.
Biden had no clue what to do when he did that.
Lindo Zay, longtime contributor to Dome Theory. Rocco Simino, Big Joe 2020, but J-O, not J-O-E fan. great to talk to you guys, as always. Are they going to do another debate? Is there any chance that they just say, no, we're not doing this nonsense again?
Absolutely. But I much would rather see the one that Joe Rogan would put on than one with a regular news contributor.
Plus 550 mentioned a Joe Rogan in this one, but there wasn't any. I'm glad you brought that one up. Rocco, do you see Biden trying to back out or at least take some sort of stand going into the next debate?
I'm really not sure. I could see anything happening. I think just given precedent that they'll probably keep doing them and just hopefully Trump will chill out. People are obviously calling for the moderator to be able to mute the mics. I don't see that happening at all.
What I would do, like try to enact that, and if they say no, then there's the deal breaker. We can't get something done over that.
Yeah, but the networks want to host the debate no matter what. It's a huge ratings pull.
That's true, but again, I think do the candidates have the power to back out, Linda?
No, not at all. Either of them back out and it looks horrific to
their
voter.
That's true.
Yep. And the mic muting thing would be even worse, because one, how does it look that you can mute the president of the United States,
yep,
regardless of how you feel about him? And what if he even, I doubt he even knows it, but what if he pulls out the Reagan line when he's like, I am paying for these debates? So, you know, I don't think that happens at all. But if Biden pulls out, people are just going to say Trump proved he was weak. If Trump pulls out, which he never would, his supporters might, you know, lose some faith in him. So,
thank you, Justin Poulin. Thanks, Rocco Simino. Thank you, Lindo Zay. Subscribe to Dome Theory. We're on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, all those places. Check out the YouTube channel, Bobby Manning. Hopefully, we don't have to talk about this again tonight. It was pretty necessary.